Welcome to That Was Radio, where we explore all aspects of the golden age of radio, not just the radio programs themselves, but also the personalities and events that shaped those programs. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. On this episode, we're going to look at Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, one of the best and most popular detective programs, and also the last dramatic series of the Golden Era to be broadcast. Ever since the earliest days of radio, action dramas featuring police and detectives were extremely popular. Hundreds of such programs aired during radio's golden age, and their popularity seems to have peaked after World War II. Broadcast historian Elizabeth MacLeod gives an interesting perspective on this. She says, "The post-war years were the golden era's golden age of detective drama, a reasonably inexpensive format to produce, a reasonably easy format to write, and a reasonably simple format to cast. It was also a format with a ready appeal to bored ex-GIs and their newly suburbanized families after cleaning up that dirty business in Europe and in the Pacific. People who welcomed a touch of excitement in their entertainment. Radio detectives were just the thing." In support of MacLeod's statement about the production cost of these programs, Variety magazine in a 1950 article reported that it cost $40,000 an episode to broadcast The Jack Benny Show. This was equal to the production costs of 8 to 10 average detective programs. Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar was produced by CBS in Hollywood and ran from 1949 through 1962, except for a one-year gap in 1954 through 1955. It was and is one of the most popular of the detective series of the Golden Age. Even though Johnny Dollar technically wasn't a detective, he was an independent insurance investigator, but this distinction is totally irrelevant to anyone listening to the series. Each of the Johnny Dollar stories followed the same well-defined structure. After the routine introduction, the show began with Dollar narrating the opening lines of a letter containing the expenses he had incurred investigating an insurance matter. Each item in the expense account introduced a portion of the story that he would then tell. Here's a network promo for the program from May of 1956.
Each Monday through Friday evening, CBS Radio rings you in on the fabulous adventures of insurance investigator Johnny Dollar. Just by decoding the cryptic items in his expense account, you'll learn how a dime spent in a phone booth can lead to a scene of the wildest suspense. Then on to a sum spent for an airplane ticket, or an item for a new shoelace, and again you'll find yourself smack in the middle of a thrill-packed situation. Each new adventure moves the story forward to its dramatic payoff, when Johnny Dollar solves yet another case of arson, fraud, or murder. Every Monday through Friday night, over most of these same stations, hear Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar.
The name of the show was incorporated into the closing of each episode, with Dollar disclosing the expense account total and signing it verbally, Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. For the first few seasons, Dollar was just like the typical cop or private eye of the period. That is, he was tough, wisecracking, and cynical. It may be that the show was initially intended to be a bit of a satire, because some of the wisecracks were pretty silly. For example, in early episodes, the writers had Dollar saying such lines as, "That kid's liquor sure can hold him," and "Everything about her kept flagging down my train of thought." From the beginning, though, Dollar's being an independent investigator gave the series a degree of freedom not seen in standard detective shows. There was no partner, no assistant, and no secretary for Johnny. He was the only recurring character, and the type of case and the supporting cast could vary widely from episode to episode. This allowed for much more creativity and flexibility in the plots than the typical crime drama, and also allowed the program to bring in some excellent actors for supporting roles. For example, one of the very best of radio's women actors, Virginia Gregg, appeared regularly, playing a wide range of characters, including occasionally taking the role of Betty Lewis, Dollar's girlfriend. Although his home office was in Hartford, Connecticut, Dollar's investigations took him all over the country and around the world. One week he might be in San Francisco investigating a claim related to the sinking of a freighter. The next week he could be in New York looking into a life insurance claim that involved a suspected murder. Then another week he might travel to some exotic locale in Africa or the Middle East checking on a claim involving stolen diamonds. There were six different actors who played Johnny Dollar over the 13-year span of the program. During the tenure of the first three, the character was largely played along the lines of the radio detective stereotype. Most of the Johnny Dollar episodes, including two auditions, are still available. This allows us to do a little comparison that I think will be interesting. CBS originally wanted Dick Powell for the series and had him audition for the part. After he turned it down, the network hired Charles Russell, a relative unknown, for the part. One of the episodes that Russell did is virtually the same script as the Powell audition. So this gives us the opportunity to compare what the network wanted with what they actually got.
It was a garage that belonged to a residence on the parallel street a block away. The living quarters upstairs were dark enough to look interesting. I indulged in a bit of genteel breaking and entering. Entering that old barn didn't take much breaking. I crept up the stairs. It sounded like they were left over from an old ghost story. And so did the first voice I heard when I stopped halfway up.
We've got to be careful, especially about that Johnny Dollar. Are you sure he didn't follow you?
That voice sounded awfully dry to be coming from a guy who supposedly had spent most of the night snoozing in the bottom of the Hudson River. It was Milford Brooks III.
Get up on your feet, Brooks.
Now, wait a minute.
I started this thing slugging you, and I might as well finish it the same way.
Leave him alone.
Now, pull in the claws, Angel. And sit on his lap.
You hard-footed, eh? I'll kill you.
Get off of me. Huh? I should have known better than to get mixed up with a low-class female like you.
Why, you punk?
Now, hold it. We've pushed the lady around enough, Brooks.
Tell me to be careful, will you? Why didn't you think of that before you led him here?
Wipe your nose, little boy.
Now, don't you go getting fat-headed, gorgeous. I'm only interested in one thing. Saving the insurance company $2 million. And, Buster, I think you've done it for me.
Dollar, I...
This is insurance fraud. It has been, ever since you put on that fake suicide attempt. Trying to extort $500,000 out of the company.
Dollar, wait a minute.
Ah, come on. We're leaving.
Dick Powell played detective roles on numerous radio shows and in the movies, so he obviously had a believable detective-like voice. Now let's hear the Charles Russell version of this scene for comparison.
It was a garage that belonged to a residence on a parallel street a block away. I made out a for sale sign on one of the big doors. The living quarters upstairs were dark enough to look interesting, so I indulged in a bit of genteel breaking and entering. Entering that old barn didn't take much breaking. I tripped up the stairs. It sounded like they were left over from an old ghost story. And so did the first voice I heard when I stopped, halfway up.
So we've got to be careful, especially about that Johnny Dollar. Are you sure he didn't follow you?
That voice sounded awful dry to be coming from a guy who supposedly had spent most of the night snoozing on the bottom of the Hudson River. It was Milford Brooks III.
Get up on your feet, Brooks.
Now, wait a minute.
No!
I started this thing slugging you. I might as well finish it the same way.
Leave him alone. He's mine.
Pull in the claws, Angel, and sit on his lap.
You Connecticut hick, I'll kill you.
Look, I'm the last guy in the world who enjoys physical violence, give or take. But believe me, you two are coming mighty close to changing my whole character. Now, settle down before I really lose my head.
Get off of me. I should have known better than to get mixed up with a low-class nobody like you.
Cut. We've pushed the lady around enough, Brooks.
Tell me to be careful. Why didn't you think of that before you let him here?
Wipe your nose, big boy.
Don't you go getting fat-headed gorgeous. Neither one of you is exactly what I'd call a mastermind. When you planted that match folder underneath the top coat on the ferry boat, you both should have been more careful.
You think so?
You bet I think so. If I were planning a piece of evidence to incriminate Mr. Harold Hatcher, I would have left a cigarette lighter. I found one in the pocket of every suit he owns back there in his closet in the club. It wasn't hard to figure out that that guy never carries a book of matches. What do you want? I'm only interested in one thing, saving the insurance company $2 million. And Buster, I think you've done it for me.
Wait, look, Dollar.
This is insurance fraud. It has been ever since you put on that fake suicide attempt, trying to extort $500,000 out of the company for you and Janelle.
Wait a minute.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we're featuring the detective series, Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. As I mentioned, Dick Powell decided not to take the role, so CBS went with Charles Russell to be the first Johnny Dollar. He was in the role from February 1949 through January 1950. Russell had neither a strong nor distinctive voice. You might have noticed this in the clip, where in several places it was difficult to distinguish the voice of the Milton Brooks character from that of Johnny Dollar. John Abbott, in his book on the series, has an apt description of how Dollar was portrayed while Russell was in the role. Abbott says he was sarcastic, irreverent, droll, and somewhat lecherous. He always got the bad guy, and generally the girl as well. An unflattering aspect of Dollar at this point in the series is that he padded the expense account, often in seeming defiance of the client. The series improved noticeably when CBS chose Edmund O'Brien as the second Johnny Dollar. O'Brien was a well-known commodity, having appeared frequently on Broadway and in 18 movies by the time he joined the series in February 1950. He had a strong, distinctive voice that worked well on radio. The writing improved as well. The character was now much more businesslike, if somewhat darker, and the items on his expense account were arguably legitimate. During the O'Brien era, the series began the Johnny Dollar tradition of adding matter to the titles of each story. The Abel Tackett matter, the Port-au-Prince matter, the Confidential matter, and so on. O'Brien remained in the title role until September 1952, appearing in about 100 episodes. After taking a few months off, Yours Truly Johnny Dollar returned, this time with John Lund in the title role. Though not as well known as Edmund O'Brien, Lund was an experienced actor who had also appeared on Broadway, and he had been in 17 movies by the time he moved behind the microphone to become America's fabulous freelance investigator. Lund's version of Dollar softened the edges a bit as compared to O'Brien's. Overall, he did a very serviceable job. Dollar was now being portrayed as an extremely diligent and qualified professional, and the expense account was strictly legit. Lund was in the role for just under 2 years and also tallied about 100 episodes. Even though Yours Truly Johnny Dollar ranked in the top 25 programs with Lund at the mic, the series was canceled in September 1954. This was a time when many popular radio programs had already been dropped, as audiences were turning more and more to television for entertainment. So, while fans were disappointed with the cancellation, they probably weren't all that surprised. But Johnny Dollar was not dead. On October the 3rd, 1955, after a year of what was euphemistically called a hiatus, the program resumed with a new production team. Radio veteran Jack Johnstone was now the producer, director, and frequent writer. But probably the most important change was moving Bob Bailey into the title role. Bailey had been very popular as Detective George Valentine for 8 years in a West Coast program called Let George Do It. There was also a new format that would set the series apart from usual detective offerings. The cases were now done as a serial, with each story running 5 days a week for 15 minutes an episode. The new format and crew helped attract some of the best writers in Hollywood and allowed them to turn out a top-notch product. With 75 minutes on the air, rather than the previous 30, there was now time to build more complex and interesting storylines and to develop more realistic characters. Bob Bailey is generally considered to be the best of the Johnny Dollars. He not only had a great voice, but he also gave a much more nuanced interpretation to the character. Bailey's Dollar was tough enough to handle himself, but he wasn't a bully. He was streetwise without being overly cynical. With Bailey in the role, Dollar could convincingly be tough or tender or introspective as the occasion called for, often within a single episode. There were 55 of the serialized stories produced, and these are considered by many old-time radio fans to be some of the finest radio dramas ever broadcast. But as with all good things, the serialized episodes came to an end, in this case on November the 2nd, 1956. Afterwards, the series reverted to the once-a-week 30-minute format. In February 1982, John Dunning interviewed Bob Bailey's daughter, Roberta Goodwin. As a teenager, she had often accompanied her father to the studio during the taping of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. In the following clip, she gives an eyewitness account of the production process. I want to note that I've edited the discussion because, to be honest, the 44-minute interview wandered around all over the place.
He went down Sunday. We lived in Pacific Palisades. It was about a 20-mile drive down to Hollywood, down to the big K&X studios on Hollywood Boulevard. Now they've been turned into the CBS television studios when radio went out. But then I would drive him down and stay with him the whole day while they got the show ready to go on the air during the week.
When you went down to the studio, which was KNX Los Angeles, was that attached to CBS, or that was the CBS affiliate?
That was CBS.
That was CBS.
That was CBS, but it was the radio. Now, when CBS, it was Columbia Broadcasting System. But it is quite a big building, about six stories high.
At the time we're talking about now, which would have been in the late 50s, right? Right up until 1962.
Yeah.
You did it on tape then, rather than live.
They taped it. Some of the earlier ones were done live. He would go down, and they would be done. Some of the half hour ones were done live.
And we're talking about sound effects that were essentially that were not live. I mean, they didn't have a band there, did they?
No,
they had them on cartridge or on
Matt,
tape.
If you can picture one whole corner of a huge, and I mean a huge room. We're talking about 60 feet long by about 40 feet wide, completely covered with that acoustical tile from floor to ceiling, and then carpeted with very thick pile rugs so that no sound would be heard. One whole corner is taken up with about five or six turntables, a thing of bells that hung down, different doors that would open and close, big doors and little doors, cowbells, all sorts of paraphernalia so the sound man could make any noise that he wanted to. No, the sound man had quite a job.
When you went down there, you were actually in this big empty place. It was a Sunday morning, and you did the whole thing.
The studio was closed, so I could run around all over the studio. You'd first go in, and everyone would sit around a huge table. The whole cast would sit around the table, have some donuts, have some coffee, and do a read-through. And then they'd do another read-through with a stopwatch, because they had to allow time for commercials, even back then. And then they do a walkthrough, and then they get ready to record it. Then I had to leave the room, go upstairs, and get in the sound booth. And then I would sit in the sound booth where the sound, not the men who made the noise, but the men who recorded it, the engineers would sit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd watch the show up from the sound booth while they recorded it.
What can you tell me about Jack Johnstone? Now, he was involved, I don't know if he was involved in the first show back in 1949, but he certainly was more closely related to that series than anybody else.
Well, all the time I was ever went down or being aware of the show, he was always there. The two scripts I have, dated 55 and 57, both have his name down here as being producer-director. So as long as Dad was there, he was there.
What do you remember about him and his directing methods?
He was marvelous to watch. He would sit behind a lectern on a high stool, and he would have the script in front. And sometimes he would remind me of a snake. He would weave back and forth on the stool, giving what they call cues. He would have to cue the music, cue a sound effect, cue the actor by rather pointing at them. And sometimes he'd be like an orchestra leader, and he would just, it was hypnotizing to watch him as he brought everyone together and worked everyone through. That's literally what he did. He was the director of the program. Like an orchestra leader, he orchestrated all these different individuals till they got the finished product. That, and he was a wonderful man.
Was he authoritarian?
Yes.
In other words, when he told you to do something, you did it.
Yes, yes. When he said quiet, this was it. Everybody knew that he meant it, yeah.
In order to further develop a picture of how these recording sessions were conducted, I also have a clip from Jack Johnstone in which he explains his directing style and the reasoning behind it. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM.
I directed in the studio, wearing a pair of earphones with heavy muffs on them so that I couldn't hear any sounds directly. I'm thoroughly convinced it was the only way to direct a radio program for several reasons. It gave you much better control over the whole show. If the show began to run a little slowly, a guy could stand in the control room and wave his arms frantically until some actor looked up, or maybe all of them, then they all sped up, and then the next signal was, you see. Whereas in the studio, right next to the actors, I could tell one actor to speed up just a little bit, and another one perhaps even to slow down. If an actor was too close to Mike, I could push him back gently or move him in. Sound effect cues were never missed when I was in the studio. I preferred directing on CBS over the other networks simply because of the personnel involved. They were far more interested in, all they gave a hoot about was putting on a good show.
Near the end of 1960, CBS decided to move the program from Hollywood to New York in order to cut production costs. Bailey chose to stay in Hollywood. His last performance as Johnny Dollar was on November the 27th, 1960. The New York run began in December of 1960 with Bob Reddick in the title role. Reddick had done a lot of radio, but not in roles of any significance. He had been active as a child actor on radio and had done a lot of soap operas. He wasn't bad, but after having heard Bob Bailey for 5 years, audiences were understandably disappointed. The audience response to the role change gave the writers an opportunity for some tongue-in-cheek humor, however. In an episode called The Who's Who Matter, a con artist has been impersonating Dollar, so the real Johnny goes to investigate. During the first third of the show, Riddick's Dollar is told repeatedly that he's not the real Johnny Dollar. Apparently, CBS was not entirely satisfied that Riddick was the real Dollar either, as he only lasted in the role for 6 months, logging just 29 episodes. Mandel Kramer then became Johnny Dollar. For many fans, he is second in popularity to Bob Bailey. Kramer had lots of radio experience. He had appeared regularly on some of the classic radio programs of the era, such as Cavalcade of America, Suspense, Gangbusters, and X-1. He is best known, of course, for being the last of the Johnny Dollars. Kramer took over the role on July 11, 1961, and held the part until the series ended on September the 30th, 1962. As I've mentioned, the best of the Johnny Dollar stories were the five-part, 15-minute series, but I've found that they cannot be edited down for inclusion on a 60-minute program. So the Johnny Dollar story that I've chosen for our program today is one of the 30-minute episodes entitled The Markham Matter. To help give a better perspective on the program, you need to know that the $150,000 worth of policy mentioned in the story would be valued at just under $1.5 million today. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is Ed Porter, Mr. Dollar. You called my office?
Yes, I'd like to see you as soon as I can, Mr. Porter.
Well, of course. How long have you been in town?
About a half an hour.
Are you all squared away?
I've got a room and I've had a bath, if that's what you mean.
Well, then I guess you're ready to go to work.
I will be as soon as I put on some pants.
You sound in a rush.
I'm always in a rush when I think somebody might be chipping us out of $100,000.
Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Thank you.
Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Western Life and Trust Company, 826 Spear Boulevard, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is an account of expenses incurred during my investigation of the Markham matter. Expense account item 1, $143.69, air transportation from Hartford to San Francisco. Item 2, $17 for incidentals along the way, including transportation from the airport to the St. Francis Hotel. I walked the 8 blocks to the Commodore building where Ed Porter had his office on the 4th floor. He was a short, thin insurance broker with a face like a tight drum. He apologized for the clammy weather as though it were his fault. He asked me how things were out on the East Coast and invited me to sit down and looked as uncomfortable as he was.
I got the telegram you were coming last night. Investigator. I've never met one in all my years in the business. Must be very interesting work.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Mr. Porter, but I would like to get some information from you.
Oh, certainly, Mr. Dollar.
What can you tell me about a man named Floyd Markham?
Markham? Well, he's the husband of a client of mine. I've met him, but I really can't tell you too much about him. My dealings have always been with Mrs. Markham. She's my customer.
Then tell me about Mrs. Markham.
Oh, certainly. I'm not going to ask why. I'm sure you have a good reason for coming all the way to San Francisco.
The home office thinks I have an excellent reason.
Yes. Mrs. Markham. Well, I've known her for 20 years as a customer. She's wealthy, always has been, and she handles her money well, and she lives rather well.
Mrs. Markham's the one who has the money, huh?
Mr. Markham is a salaried man, an industrial engineer. Frankly, I think he depends on Mrs. Markham for his livelihood.
Oh, yeah. These 2 checks were issued to Mrs. Markham this year. Recognize them?
Yes. Full payments on 2 endowment policies, $50,000 apiece. And they've cleared the bank. Anything wrong with them?
Nothing wrong with the checks.
On payoffs like this, I always take it in person. It's a custom, of course, to call and make an appointment and deliver the check to the client.
Mm-hmm. And try to sell a little more insurance in the bargain.
Well, that's about the idea, yes.
Yeah. Anything strange about Mrs. Markham when you delivered either one of these checks?
Well, no.
Before I left Hartford, I looked up her insurance records. Her premiums are always paid right on the button. Mrs. Markham doesn't have a business office or a business manager handling her affairs. The checks are always personal checks on her personal account. Now, can you explain why someone like that might forget a 3rd endowment policy?
Why, no.
Well, there is a 3rd endowment policy. It matured this month. I have the check with me for $50,000.
Well, yes, but this business of forgetting...
Floyd Markham called Hartford and spoke to the head of the endowment division. He explained that Mrs. Markham was ill and didn't know whether or not a 3rd policy existed. He said he was checking for her.
Uh-huh.
Now, you say you've known Mrs. Markham over a period of 20 years. Well, is she the kind of person who'd forget $50,000?
No one forgets $50,000.
Did you notice that both of those checks were deposited in the Markham's joint account?
Well, no. So they were. Maybe Mrs. Markham's feeling generous these days.
Now, why do you say that?
Well, they have a rather strange relationship as far as I've been able to perceive. I mean, what money he makes is his and what she has is hers.
Oh, yeah.
I always like to get out of that house because they never seem to me to be a very close couple in any way. But this seems to make sense now.
How's that, Mr. Porter?
Well, now, I called up and made an appointment to deliver both of these checks. The first time I went over, Mrs. Markham was ill. And the second time, she had just stepped out for a few minutes.
Well, who accepted the checks?
Mr. Markham.
Both times?
Yes. As a matter of fact, now that I think of it, he made the appointment on the phone both times.
When was the last time you saw Mrs. Markham?
Last spring.
A check with the bank revealed that Mrs. Markham had not personally made a deposit since June the 18th. The deposit slips were initialed by Floyd Markham. The checks were endorsed by Leslie Markham. There had been no unusual withdrawal. Expense account item 3, $30, stenographic and notary services for the attached statements.
Mrs. Markham has been having her hair done here for nearly 10 years now. Once a week, every Thursday morning. Then she just stopped. I called her home, and Mr. Markham informed me that she was away on an extended trip. Mr. Markham called us, it was last June, and informed us that Mrs. Markham was resigning her membership in the Bridge Club. I telephoned the house twice to see what was the matter. Mr. Markham answered both times and said Mrs. Markham was out.
Well, she used to come in here two or three times a month. Made us go over the car from top to bottom. She hasn't been around now for 7 or 8 months. I don't know who's taking care of the car.
Expense account item 430 cents, 3 phone calls to the Markham residence. I didn't state any particular business. I simply asked to speak to Mrs. Markham. Each time I called, a male voice answered. Each time, the male voice told me Mrs. Markham was out, she was ill, and she was away on a short trip. Industrial Management Limited, Floyd B. Markham President, has a 3-room office suite near the Embarcadero. 10 years ago, it had been sensationally new and glassy. When I got there, the carpet was a little too thin and the varnish a little too thin, too. The whole place smelled faintly of mildew.
Yes?
I'd like to see Mr. Markham, please.
Do you have an appointment?
No, not exactly. My name is Harris. I'm with the Cleveland Pump Company.
Pump Company?
Yes, we're setting in 38 of our installations at the new plant in Valparaiso. Didn't you get my letter?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm afraid... May I ask your name again?
Harris, Stephen B. Harris, Cleveland Pump Company.
Oh, yes. Well, Mr. Harris, I'm afraid Mr. Markham never received your letter. When did you mail it?
30 days ago. Maybe it was 2 weeks. Well, tell Mr. Markham I'm here and I'll...
I'm sorry, Mr. Harris. Mr. Markham isn't in the office just now.
Oh. Well, I'll wait.
Well? He won't be in today. As a matter of fact, he won't be in the rest of the week.
Where can I call him?
Well, I'm afraid that's impossible.
Can't I call him at home?
No.
Now, look, is he in business or isn't he?
Mr. Harris, Mr. Markham hasn't been in the office for 6 months or more. He's tied up on a rather long-range project.
What's your name?
I'm Miss Bidler.
Why didn't you say that in the first place, Miss Bidler?
Well,
who else can I talk to here?
No one, I'm afraid.
You mean that's all there is in this office? Just you and him, when he feels like coming in?
I'll tell Mr. Markham you were here.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM.
The Markham house was on Fiorella Street, about 6 blocks from the Fairmont Hotel. Stone walls, iron grillwork, tangling ivy. An old house that had been built by rich people for rich people to live in. A place that only New Yorkers and San Franciscans can get by with and still be called wealthy. I used Ed Porter's car with the Western Life and Trust Company emblem on the door, parked it in the driveway as close as I could to the entrance. It was exactly 1 o'clock when the door opened. He was tall and pretty with black hair and broad shoulders.
Yes? What is it?
I'd like to see Mrs. Markham, please.
I'm Mr. Markham. Can I help you?
My name's Dollar. I'm with Western Life and Trust Company. Mr. Porter called you?
No, he didn't.
Oh, well, it must have slipped his mind. He said he was going to call.
What's it about?
I brought a check from Mrs. Markham on her third endowment policy.
Oh. Well, I'll give it to her. She isn't in right now.
Well, I'm supposed to deliver it to her. I'll come back another time when she's in.
Well, you can give it to me. I'll see that she gets it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Markham, but I have
to get it. Look, I know you want to give her the check and try to sell her some more insurance. She's just not in the market. And you can save a little spiel where it'll do some good.
Oh, you misunderstand me, Mr. Markham. I have to deliver this to her in person.
What's your name again?
Dollar. Johnny Dollar.
Come in.
I'll wait till she comes back and make an appointment. Mr. Porter told me he'd made it for 3 today.
She's here. Just come in.
Why the runaround, then?
Mrs. Markham is desperately ill. I don't want to disturb her with things like this.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. What's the trouble?
There is serious anemia. So if you'll just give me the
check...
I have a report
to make out when I deliver this.
I just...
Only take a minute to hand her the check. Then it'll be off my mind and off your mind.
Now, look here, Mr.
Didn't you call the company's home office about this check?
I called because Mrs. Markham requested me to call.
Oh, yes.
Just wait here.
In the little swirl of his exit, I smelled shaving lotion and guessed at the brand name. I also guessed that his suit cost $300, even if I didn't know what San Francisco tailor had made it. The shirt, the tie, the shoes were expensive, too. Yeah, Mr. Floyd Markham liked expensive things. I wondered if he dyed his hair to keep it all black. I wondered if he was 45 or 50. I also wondered why, in a house of that size, on that kind of street, a servant hadn't answered the door.
This way, Mr. Dollar.
He led me up a flight of stairs and finally into a high-ceilinged room with a fireplace at one end. A gray-haired woman with a sharp, angular face was seated near the window, looking out over the city and the bay. She didn't turn her head when we came into the room, but I could see that her eyes were watery and slightly glazed.
Please don't take too long and don't upset her. Leslie. Leslie, dear.
Yes, Lord.
This is Mr. Dollar from the insurance company. He has something for you. Now be a good girl, Leslie, and speak to Mr. Dollar.
How do you do?
And ask him...
Yes. How is Mr. Porter?
Oh, he's fine, Mrs. Markham, fine. He'll be sorry to hear that you've been ill.
I really would rather that you didn't tell Mr. Porter.
Oh.
I'm satisfied to make my own slow recovery and not worry any of my friends. He'd like some sherry, Floyd.
Now you know what the doctor said, Leslie.
Mr. Dollar, you'd like some sherry, wouldn't you?
Why, yes, I'd like that very much.
Floyd?
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Dollar. It's absolutely forbidden, and you know that, dear. Do you have the check, Mr. Dollar?
Yes, right here. Here you are, Mrs. Markham.
Thank you.
Is there anything else, Mr. Dollar?
Well,
Mr. Dollar?
Now, Leslie.
Yes? What is it, Mrs. Markham?
I'm very tired. Excuse me if I seem impolite. Good day.
Good day, Mrs. Markham. Expense account item 5, 10 cents. Phone call to Ed Porter at his office.
Yes, Mr. Dollar?
Look, Mrs. Markham's 5'5", about 120, black hair, gray streak to the right of the part, blue eyes, looks about 40 years old, a good 40.
Why, yes, that sounds like her. You mean you've seen her?
I've seen what's left of her, Mr. Porter.
Oh, good Lord, she's not dead.
Almost.
What?
He's killing her, Mr. Porter. My guess is he's been at it for about 6 months.
Act two of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, in just a moment. Nobody will take a frown at face value anymore now that the word has gotten around about Jack Benny's return to the air. With Mary Livingston, Dennis Day, Rochester, Don Wilson, Mel Blanc, Frank Nelson, and Mr. Kitzel, nothing less than your very best smile will do for the occasion. Tonight, and every Sunday night, hear CBS Radio's Jack Benny Show and give your sense of humor a real workout. Now, Act Two of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar and the Markham Matter.
Take a rich old house on a rich old street in San Francisco. Walk in with a legitimate insurance check for $50,000 and tell a man named Floyd Markham you want to deliver it to his wife. Tell him this when you know that no one has seen or heard from his wife in 6 months. Just tell him you want to see her. Insist that you see her. Then stand around and listen to him lie a couple of times. Then let him take you to her. Give her the check. Say goodbye. 20 minutes after I walked out of the Markham's house and picked up Ed Porter, we drove back to the house and parked 100 feet from the entrance.
This is the darndest thing I ever heard of, Mr. Dollar. I'm not sure it's all clear to me. What's our position?
Oh, I wouldn't know that, Mr. Porter. That's up to the legal department. This much I'm sure of right now. Markham's already deposited $100,000 of her insurance money into a joint account. If I'm not mistaken, this last check will go into that account, too. Right now, while we're sitting here, she's probably endorsing that check.
Well, then I don't see where it's any of our
business. He's making her endorse the check. He's making her stay in that house, in that room, away from everybody.
Well, how? What way? He said she was ill. You said she appeared ill. I don't see
I don't know how he's doing it, but I'm going to find out.
Are you sure this isn't all surmise on your part?
You weren't in the room when she said, let's have some sherry. Please, let's have some sherry.
Well, I must be pretty dumb.
She was really trying to say she wanted him to leave the room so she could talk to me. So she could have one little minute to tell me what the matter is, what's going on. His next move is to deposit that check. Then one big withdrawal, the whole $150,000, and bye-bye Floyd Markham.
Mr. Dollar, I'm just an insurance broker. I don't understand. Well,
how'd you like to be an investigator for about 10 minutes?
Me?
Yeah. You see that car that just pulled up in the driveway?
Well, yes.
The girl driving it holds down that dummy office of Markham's. Her name's Beidler. She might be in on this with him.
And that's Mr. Markham leaving the house.
Good. Now, look, here's what you do. Follow them. I think I know where they're going, but you follow them and make sure.
Well, where are they going?
To the bank to deposit that check.
Oh. Well, where are you going?
To have that glass of sherry, Mr. Porter. Ed Porter pulled his hat down low over his face and put both hands on the wheel and took out after that 55 Cadillac sedan. I crossed the street, went back up on the porch of the house, and knocked. I didn't expect her to answer. I didn't expect anyone to answer, but I wanted to make sure. I went around to the garden. There wasn't a sound in the big old house when I opened the garden door and went up the stairs again. The door to her room was closed. She wasn't by the window anymore. She was stretched out on the divan. I felt her wrist for a pulse. It was there, faint, but there. About 3 inches up her arm, there was a series of little marks. I lifted one eyelid and felt her neck muscles. She was doped to the ears. Mrs. Markham. Mrs. Markham, can you hear me? Look, I've come to help you. Yes. Yes, I'm going to take you out of here. Now, don't be frightened.
Mr. Dollar?
That's right. That's right. That's the ticket.
Insurance company.
Yes.
Now, I remember.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you for bringing my check. I don't want...
Want what, Mrs. Markham?
Want any of my friends to worry.
Oh.
I'm improving. But I don't want them to know I'm ill. Just say I'm out of town for a while.
He told you to say that, didn't he?
Yes. He told me to say exactly that. Mr. Dollar, don't fool me. Please don't fool me.
What?
You will help me get out of here. You aren't fooling me, are you? Are you?
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we're featuring an episode of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar.
I carried her downstairs and put her in my car and drove her to the St. Regis Emergency Hospital. Expense account item $6,100, deposit with the hospital office. I explained as much as necessary to the intern who promised to advise me when Mrs. Markham became rational. After that, I drove back to the house. Ed Porter's blue coupe was parked across the street.
I didn't know what to do but come back here. And when I got back, I didn't know what to do
either.
Slow down.
You're doing fine.
Oh, you were right. You were absolutely right. They went straight to the Bank of America to deposit that money.
I kind of thought they might be back here by now.
No, they're over at Angelo's having a drink and some dinner. I followed them there.
You're getting to be quite a sleuth, Mr. Porter.
Well, I try to do my best and use my head. Mr. Dollar, did you talk to Mrs. Markham?
As much as I could. She was doped. I took her out and put her in the hospital.
Oh. Well, should you have done that, Mr. Dollar?
I could have left her up in that room to die, Mr. Porter.
Oh, yes. Well, what's our next move?
Ours?
Well, certainly. I can't quit now, Mr. Johnny.
Well, let's go to Angelo's. Eddie. Ed Porter settled the hat lower on his ears and gripped the wheel harder, and we took off for Angelo's on Stoker Street. When we got there, we didn't have to go inside to see if our people were still around. The Cadillac sedan was in the parking lot. So we took up a plant across the street.
Well, why wait? Why not go in and take them out of there and take them down to the police?
Well, that might blow the whole thing. Now, we have to wait and see what Mrs. Markham has to say when she's well enough to talk.
Yeah, but...
I'm sure she'll have some charges to prefer. In the meantime, we wait and see what's what.
And what do you think he'll do when he goes home and finds her gone?
Well, that'll be pretty interesting. What do you think he'll do?
Well, I imagine he'll, he'll think she got up and walked out.
No, he knows better than that. He's had her doped up for 6 months. He knows he can go out of the house and she'll stay right where he left her while he's gone. No, that isn't it.
Oh. Well, then he'll know that she had help.
That's more like it, Mr. Porter.
I liked Eddie. It gives me kind of a feeling.
Okay, Eddie. Now answer the question.
Oh, what'll he do? Well, he'll try to get out of town. That's it. He'll try to leave town. He'll know that he's had it.
Come on.
Huh?
They're pulling out. We followed them to a cocktail lounge near the Presidio. We waited around outside the place for 2 hours. Expense account item 725 cents. I called the St. Regis Receiving Hospital. Mrs. Markham's condition was unchanged. Item 8, $2, 2 hamburgers, 2 Cokes and cigarettes for Mr. Porter and myself. We had just finished eating when Floyd Markham's Cadillac turned out onto the street. We followed it for 10 minutes. When Markham parked on a dark hill, we cut our lights and came to a stop.
Mr. Dollar?
Yeah, Eddie?
Can you see what they're doing?
Yeah.
What?
Necking.
Huh?
Necking. You know.
I should have telephoned my wife.
At 12:10, Floyd Markham turned the car around and drove back into town. We followed once more. We saw him double park outside a 4-story apartment house on a steep hill, let the woman out, then drive on. Eddie?
Yeah, Johnny?
Think you can handle something else alone?
Oh, I'd love to.
Women sometimes talk a lot easier than men. You keep on him. When he finds his wife absent, I want to know where he goes.
Wherever it is, I'll let you know. You gonna shake her down?
Something like that. Yeah. Get going. I watched my new assistant investigator follow out after Markham's Cadillac. Then I went inside the apartment house. I bought it was on the mailbox of apartment 104. I walked down the hall, listened a minute, and gave it a try.
Yes? Well, what on earth are you doing?
I'm here to see you, Miss Bidler. It's important.
You're, Mr. Harris.
I'm Mr. Dollar, Johnny Dollar. I'm an insurance investigator.
Oh. There was something about you today. I wasn't sure.
Now you're sure.
Oh, what are you doing?
Right now, I'm working for Western Life and Trust Company. You'd better sit down.
Well, I don't know that I'd better do anything, Mr. Dollar. You're rather rude.
Then you can stand. We've been checking into Floyd Markham. I don't think I have to tell you what we found out so far. I think you also know that by this time tomorrow, he'll be in jail and you might be right along with him.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Dollar. I simply
don't...
Don't
be sorry. Just use your head. I said you might be right along with him. On the other hand, if you have some useful information, the insurance company might be useful to you.
What do you mean?
Well, I figure he sold you on an island trip or an estate in the country bill of goods. It'll be harder getting it out of him, but we'll get it one way or another. We'll get it all right. Now, what do you want to do?
I want a drink. You?
Oh, thanks.
I'm not bad. I'm not a criminal. I've never been in trouble.
You are now.
Why? Because I fell in love with him?
Because you were helping him kill her.
What are you talking about?
Mrs. Markham. She's in a hospital right now.
What?
I took her there myself today. He's had her doped with I don't know what for months. Having her sign checks, endorse deposit slips.
Funny.
Is it?
He told me that Mrs. Markham was out of town, divorcing him. I wondered how. You were right. It was a country estate. In England. A genteel life, he said. The London theater, walks in the country. Little harmless things that most people can never do. He said we could do them as soon as he cleaned up his affairs. By tonight, he said we could start packing.
I took Iris Bidler with me back to the Markham house. The Cadillac was in the garage, and Ed Porter's blue coupe was pulled up across the street. When he saw us in the cab, he walked up.
Hi.
Hi. How's he doing? You can talk in front of her.
Well, he hasn't done anything. I mean, I saw the light go on upstairs in Mrs. Markham's room, then it went out again. He's downstairs now, sitting in the living room.
Okay, wait here. Hello, Markham.
Hello.
If you're worried about your wife, which I doubt, she's in a hospital.
Are you a policeman?
Insurance investigator. That's Miss Bidler in the taxi over there.
Oh.
I want you to come with me now.
Of course. Yes. You said your name was Dollar?
That's right.
Why couldn't you have come around, say, next week?
She'd have been dead by then.
That's the way she should have been for 16 years. Dead.
Yeah. Come on, Markham. Expense account, item 9, $102, hotel and board in San Francisco. Item 10, $116, airfare back to Hartford. Item 11, $42.16, miscellaneous. Remarks? I'm going to wind up in court. Mrs. Markham's charges will include attempted homicide, attempt to defraud, attempt to... In the end, it was his attempt to run away, and it didn't work. It never works. Even if you get away, you find something new to run from. Total expenses, $968.20. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Now, here's our star to tell you about next week's story.
Next week in our story, New Orleans, the French Quarter, a beautiful girl, and high adventure. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone. Heard in tonight's cast were Lois Corbett, Frank Nelson, Virginia Gregg, Bert Holland, Paula Winslow, and John Daner. Musical supervision by Amerigo Marino. Be sure to join us next week, same time and station, for another exciting story of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we're featuring the classic old-time radio series, Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. We've just heard an episode entitled The Markham Matter. In the mid-1950s, television was drawing more and more of the audience away from radio's dramatic programming. So local affiliates began dropping network shows and doing their own programming using what Elizabeth MacLeod calls platter and chatter. This allowed them to make more money by selling frequent advertising slots to sponsors in their listening area. By the late 1950s, it was clear that network radio drama was coming to an end. When Mandel Kramer made his first appearance as the last Johnny Dollar on June 11, 1961, CBS had only three dramatic programs on the air each week: Gunsmoke, Suspense, and Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. And they dropped Gunsmoke the very next week. Then on September 30, 1962, the last vestige of what is now referred to as the Golden Age of Radio came to an end, when Suspense and Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar each went on the air for the last time. Suspense had been on for 20 years, and Johnny Dollar for 13. So what happened to all those actors who played Johnny Dollar after they left the series? Charles Russell disappeared from acting after his tenure as the first Johnny Dollar. Virtually the same applies to the fifth Dollar, Bob Riddick. Edmund O'Brien, the second actor to play Johnny Dollar, was, of course, a major movie star. He won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of Oscar Muldoon in The Barefoot Contessa in 1954, and received a Best Supporting Actor nomination for his role as a drunken senator in 7 Days in May in 1964. He also received 2 Golden Globe Awards. During his acting career, he appeared in over 100 movies and dozens of television shows. After his time as the third Johnny Dollar, John Lund appeared in about 12 movies, including High Society in 1956. In a non-acting capacity, Lund served as vice president of the Screen Actors Guild from 1950 through 1959. The last of the Johnny Dollars, Mandel Kramer, had a long career in both television and radio after the series ended. He was on the TV soap opera The Edge of Night from 1961 to 1979, playing Police Chief Bill Marceau. When CBS attempted to rekindle interest in radio drama with the CBS Mystery Theater between 1974 and 1982, Kramer returned to radio, appearing in more than 100 episodes. Bob Bailey, the fourth and best of the actors to play Johnny Dollar, had probably the saddest life after he left the series. Bailey was an alcoholic, but had kept it under control for 22 years. After he left the Johnny Dollar series, his life seemed to fall apart. His wife divorced him, and he wasn't able to get regular work on television or in the movies. So, he again fell prey to his addiction. For 9 years, neither his friends nor his family knew where he was. Finally, he entered a rehabilitation center and was able to put his life back together. For a couple of years after that, he worked at a rehab center helping other alcoholics. Then in 1973, Bob Bailey suffered a massive stroke and spent the final 10 years of his life in a rest home, where he died on August the 13th, 1983. You've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that shaped them. On this episode, we featured the detective series Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. I hope you enjoyed the program and will join me again next time. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM.